Dr. Alan Wallace has authored or translated or contributed to over 40 books and publications on Tibetan Buddhism, modern quantum science, psychology, and culture. And after spending 14 years as a Buddhist monk, he entered an academic background with degrees in physics and religious studies. He's taught at Stanford University and the University of California at Santa Barbara, and he currently devotes his time to the Santa Barbara Institute for Consciousness Studies, which he founded, and lectures on meditation and other insightful venues. Nice to have you with us today.
A pleasure to join you, Gary.
First off, when I look at the problems we're facing today in the world, I'd like to share just a little extended introduction to the theme, and then turn it over to you to do more of a classroom on the air. Okay?
Sure, that sounds fine.
Thank you. Anyone who knows this program knows that I do more listening and less talking, but I do an extensive introduction just so that we understand context. In all the presidential debates and all the other things I see in the media, I see either people claiming there are no major problems, only little blips, with our healthcare system, with subprime mortgages, with the money market crunch in credit cards, and outside of that, nothing that bad in the environment. Yeah, there may be some problems, but they're certainly not caused by human beings, and under no circumstances should we hold corporations responsible for cleaning any of that up, because then it would adversely affect jobs and profits. On the other end of that, I hear people saying, well, that's just the opposite. We are in a perfect storm. In fact, even worse than the 1928 Depression, because then we didn't have environmental degradation. Most Americans were still living in the country and not in an urban environment, and they had net savings. Today we have they had positive savings, about 15 to 20%. Now we have negative savings of 2% and debt on top of that, which means that not only do we not have any money in the bank, but we also have astronomical debts with no way to pay them except to struggle pay period to pay period. In effect, the people we call the working class and the middle class are not in good shape, and none of the current policies seem to be helping. What I see left out of all this is pulling back and looking at the problems differently. And I'll just share a few ideas with you to show you what I'm referring to. We're not caring about the suffering around the world. We are right now just caring about our day-to-day pain, and more often than not, people are angry or in pain, and to get through their day, so they can get to night, so they can get to the weekend, so they can get to a holiday. Anything except face what they consider the emptiness of the moment. You look around and 27,000 children died in the last 24 hours around the world of starvation. India is a booming nation, and with about the same population as China, only minus about 100,000, but its population actually will exceed China, but it's in the middle of a massive development program, and its newfound wealth is causing hundreds of millions of Indians to want everything that the West has. They want plasma screen TVs, and they want to be able to go and shop in malls and spend the money they've earned. Trouble is, no one's looking out for the poor. That is also true in Africa. Even in those countries like Nigeria and the Niger Delta that have rich natural deposits of precious metals and oil, none of that seems to filter down. So when I look at the problems in the United States and around the world, the very first thing I see is we lack consciousness. We lack a spiritual consciousness by the people in any given environment to say, with the resources we have, how can we best share these resources so that everyone has a chance to have some quality of life? An example, if we gave American corporations a 100% write-off for every dollar that they donate to a food charity, and let's say, let's just take one example. Let's go to South America. Let's go to Colombia. And in Colombia, you have massive amounts of poor people, as you do in many countries in South America. If we were to give $1 a day in food subsidies and education to the poor, the education would then allow them to have a future. the food subsidies would prevent people from being susceptible to the most radical extremes of social adjustment, anarchy, violence, and would stop the breeding ground for many of the terrorists, whether it's in South America, the Path Out Loud, or any of the other areas around the world. It's rare that you find terrorism coming from affluence, from abundance. It's almost always after a long protracted period where one group has absolutely nothing, not even subsistence, and the other group has excessive wealth, like in Saudi Arabia. And if it weren't for American support of Saudi Arabia militarily, long ago the ruling family would have had their heads on a stick somewhere because the people hate them there. So I'm saying, why not simply try to bring that sense of charity consistently where we give people something that they can survive on? Now, it may not seem like a lot, but in some countries, a dollar a day to a poor person for food and then subsidize that food means that you're giving about $3 worth of food per day. And $3 a day for food would feed an awful lot of people. So you wouldn't have as many people dying. If you put schools and you subsidize schools and school teachers and pharmacies and dispensaries and hospitals throughout the world where they're needed. So you're helping to prevent poverty, you're feeding people, and yet all this is a tax write-off. So it's not as if someone necessarily has to be spiritual. They can just be wise in the business and say, isn't it better that we use this corporate profit, some small percentage of it per corporation? And that way, I did the math on this. In less than 2 years, you could feed over 2.5 billion people. You could have schools. You could have clean well water. You could have distribution of heirloom seeds in countries where people can't afford to buy the seeds. You can help them to stop deforestation and reforest. And most importantly, when a person feels comfortable that they can provide for their family, there's less incentive to be angry at the world and be the fertile ground for terrorism. Does that make any sense as one way of helping the poor, the children, deforestation, and the disparity, and also hopefully stop terrorism at one level?
Was this a question? The answer is clearly yes. Would you like to go on?
Yeah, no, I just gave you my extended introduction. I would like for you, if you can, with what you have written about and what you believe in, if you could then pull any segment of what we talked about just now and see how we're not living a reality that is not within our mindset, and yet there are alternate realities that could help people and help stop suffering if we simply paid attention to it.
Right. Well, I was listening closely throughout this wonderful introduction. I think you've pinpointed enormously important issues in terms of our engagement, our relationship to the environment, and then simply developing a sense of social responsibility that goes beyond our own local neighborhoods, our families, but also, very importantly, beyond also national boundaries. Although, of course, there's a good deal of poverty and social problems within our own country, so it's not like we've solved all our problems and now simply try to attend to others. It strikes me that there are two issues that are parallel here. You've touched on both of them. And one of these, let me frame it this way. In this modern movement, it's about 15 years old, of positive psychology, spearheaded by Martin Seligman, and now there are many other psychologists, really around the country and around the world, who are exploring this through research and also through teaching, through writing. Positive psychology is raising some very interesting questions that were overlooked to a large extent in modern psychology, especially since the Second World War. And that is, once we're normal, once we have a normal degree of psychological health, our neuroses are fairly much under control, we have only a normal level of unhappiness, frustration, and so forth, then what? And to a large extent, modern clinical psychology has basically said, well, once you're normal, once you're no more psychologically unhealthy than your therapist, then you can go home, because we have nothing more to offer you. You're normal, and likewise for your physical health, once you're normal, then you can go home. And so the whole thrust of clinical psychology over the last 60 years has been, overwhelmingly, towards treating about 300 types of mental diseases. But once people are normal, then considering, well, okay, that's it. That's the end of the conversation. What Martin Seligman and others have raised is, why should we suffer from this imagination deficit disorder to think that normal is as good as it gets, when we consider that normal is a variable and it's always identified within a certain social context. So they're raising the questions, what are our inner resources for finding a greater sense of happiness, of well-being, of fulfillment, greater sense of meaning? And so when they raise these kind of issues, what they're pointing to is an ancient Greek concept, which is called eudaimonia, human flourishing, genuine happiness. And this is a quality of well-being that comes not from the environment or from pleasant stimuli, but rather comes from the very quality of our way of life and the quality of our minds and the degree of insight that we have into the very nature of reality itself. So this is contrasted with what this genuine happiness is contrasted with hedonic pleasure or hedonic well-being, as in hedonism. But this is not meant pejoratively, and I'm not using it pejoratively either. So in addressing the themes that you raised in your introduction, on the one hand, we have this enormously important issue of global poverty, issues of health, basic issues of education, and of course addressing the environment, that we can try to restore the equilibrium with our environment rather than this ongoing degradation that has characterized the 20th century in particular. So I'd like to pause right there and just pinpoint what I regard as one of the great koans of the 20th and 21st century, as in an anomaly, a paradox, something that requires some careful attention. And that is, in the 20th century, we saw the greatest, most rapid growth of scientific knowledge and technology in the history of humanity. It was absolutely breathtaking what's taken place over the last 100, 110 years. And so one would think, with this enormous growth of knowledge, some have argued the knowledge acquired in the first 20th century is more than the knowledge of the natural world acquired in all preceding centuries. Such was the rate of growth. So one would think, well, that must have been a terrific century. With this kind of growth of scientific knowledge and, of course, all the correlated technology from horses and buggies in 1900 to now, you know, exploring Mars in the year 2000, what a tremendous century. And it was in so many ways, this extraordinary growth of knowledge and power. One would think, well, with that kind of increase of knowledge in medicine and in so many other fields, transportation, communication, and in all fields of science, one would think, boy, we must be so much happier now. There must be so much greater peace and harmony. We should be so much wiser. And then we look, well, what actually happened in the 20th century? And we saw what happened in the 20th century in terms of the environment. The greatest degradation that human beings have ever inflicted on a natural environment took place in that same century, as if there's no tomorrow. As if we have multiple worlds, we can use up, chew up and spit out planet Earth, and we've got another one to go to after we've spoiled our current one. The problem is there is no extra planet Earth that we can all migrate to after we've completely fouled our present, you know, our present environment. So how could we be so knowledgeable and so foolish in terms of the environment? And then in terms of human beings' interaction with each other, the First World War, the Second World War, we've never seen such inhumanity of human beings against human beings, of social injustices, of just genocides, of Holocaust. All of the preceding centuries, with all of the religious wars, the political wars, economic wars, none of them hold a candle to how savage human beings were towards each other in the 20th century. Morality, did we really increase in the 20th century? Ethics, just the way that we engage with each other and environment, down, not up. So this strikes me as a very important anomaly, that we could know so much, we could have so much power, and use our knowledge and power in many good ways, to be sure, but in such ways that are absolutely self-destructive to not only one country, but all of humanity, not only humanity, but the entire biosphere. We are imperiling, and of course wiping out whole species, imperiling whole ecospheres. How could we do this when we are so knowledgeable, more knowledgeable than any other time in human history? And so it strikes me here that our knowledge is imbalanced. So coming back to your theme, I think all of this is related to the introduction you gave. The points that you raise are so terribly important. If you're a child in the Sudan and you're suffering, you're starving to death, there is nothing more important to you than a meal. Any deeper issues are just secondary to your just being able to fill your stomach. If you're ill, if you're seriously ill, that is your world, that is your top priority. So for those of us who have greater affluence, who have access to medicine and so forth, this is a prime directive, one of the fundamental responsibilities to our fellow human beings and just the planet as a whole, to take the surplus and offer this, make this available, at least some significant percentage, so that those who have so little, those who are just marginal, just on subsistence, that they can be brought out of the misery of such poverty. So there is an issue that does not go away. It is absolutely important. And that's just one point that you pinpointed and highlighted, I think, in very, very meaningful ways. But there is a corollary issue you raised. And that is we have, I think it's about 1.1 billion people in India. I think it's 1.3 billion people in China. But we have in India, I've lived there for 6 years, we have a now rapidly growing middle class. They're really doing better and better. And now we have, you know, and then they just came out with this $2,500 car, so we can expect now millions of cars to be sold in India, and all of them are going to be guzzling gas, only at, what, 50, 55 miles per gallon, but nevertheless, multiply that by 10, 20, 50 million, and you certainly now are tapping more deeply into our fossil fuels, exhausting them because they are a non-replenishable resource. So on the one hand, certainly let's do all we can to alleviate poverty, whether in India and South America, poverty in the United States for that matter. But now, what about the other issue? What is the standard of the United States, the most powerful and affluent country in the world? What is the ideal we are proffering to the rest of the world by way of cable television, by way of our image, the ideals, our goals and aspirations, our values? And to a very large extent, what America stands for is get rich quick. The bottom line, as you said, let's not ask the corporations to make any sacrifices because, gosh, you know, there is the bottom line. What about the stockholders? What about the short-term profits? What about jobs? What about salaries? And so we don't want to make any sacrifices, hence the problems you pointed to. But there's an underlying and deeper issue here, I think, and that is, what do we stand for? And if all what we really stand for now in the year 2008 is America stands for get rich and hold on to your money and don't let anybody else get it. Because richer means happier. Richer means more stuff and you can be happier. This is delusion. You spoke of being in touch with reality. It is flat out delusional to think that we will be happier and happier and happier as we have $1 million and 10 million and 100 million and so forth and so on. There are multiple psychological studies here pointing out that just the level of anxiety, of misery, of psychological distress is alleviated. It's very significantly alleviated if you're coming from a position of poverty and you don't even know how you're going to get your next meal or make the payments, you know, just for the basic requisites of life. To be able to move from poverty to an economic status where you no longer need to worry about food, clothing, shelter, that you're kind of taken care of, there is a great alleviation of suffering there. But once you're paying your bills, you've hit middle class, you have some kind of comfort, sometimes kind of security, if you then increase your wealth by tenfold or a hundredfold, it has essentially no impact on your happiness at all. So here is America setting out this ideal, which China is emulating to such a large extent. To be rich is glorious, we've heard from one of the premiers of China. They are emulating us in some respects. But the problem is that our Earth, our precious Earth, does not have the resources for the 6.6 billion people on the planet to all emulate the American ideal. And so we need another ideal while giving all necessary attention to alleviating physical suffering and dealing with this hedonic well-being. Hedonic well-being being the type of well-being, the happiness, the security that we can encounter from the environment, from pleasant stimuli, from having enough to eat, decent clothing, sufficient shelter. This is immensely important. But the question comes, what then? Once we have the adequate, once we have what is necessary to be able to survive and to feel some sense of comfort, how now shall we pursue happiness? And with this imagined deficit disorder that so many of us are suffering from, well, I'm pretty happy now that I have enough. Probably if I have much more than enough, then I'll be much happier. And that's exactly where the delusion sets in. So this is where people like Martin Seligman and others have pointed out that in terms of an ideal, why don't we get real here? And simply recognizing that having excessive amounts of wealth does not give rise to extraordinary amounts of happiness, but rather anxiety, but just basically no more happiness at all, just more stuff. To shift our ideals, to shift what America stands for, that it indeed is important to overcome poverty, to provide education, sufficient medical care, and so forth. But once we have the basics in place, now what should we stand for? And what this positive psychological movement has been pointing to, and the great spiritual traditions of the world have been pointing to for millennia, is that if we're seeking greater happiness, deeper happiness, it's not found by greater wealth, by greater sensual pleasures, by greater reputation, by greater power, but rather by tapping into our inner resources. And so cultivating a way of life, this is straight from Aristotle, cultivating a way of life that gives us a greater sense of well-being, a greater and then greater mental balance, tapping into our own inner resources to tap into a sense of well-being, of insight, and happiness, fulfillment, and meaning that can come from the cultivating our own minds. So this is something that easily gets overlooked with this massive influence of materialism in our modern world, where we are now being brainwashed that the only way we can find happiness is by looking outwards or looking to drugs. And this is one of the delusions I think we must address. Otherwise, we'll always be cleaning up after the elephant, to use the old metaphor from the environmental movement, cleaning up, that is, making the mess and thinking, oh gosh, what do we do now? Let's not clean up after the elephant. Let's tackle the essential issues. And that is human flourishing, human happiness. How should we pursue this? What are the avenues? What are our resources? Look to the outer to satisfy our basic needs and to provide us with hedonic well-being. But for genuine happiness, look to the wisdom of the ancient Greeks, the Taoists, the Hindus, the Buddhists, the Christians, the Jewish tradition. There is so much wisdom there, and we've overlooked it as we have become fixated on the externals as the only source of happiness.
I really appreciate that insightful answer. Thank you. Was it not Marcus Aurelius, writing in Meditations in the 2nd century, who said, "Nowhere can man find a quieter or more untroubled retreat than his own soul"? And yet in today's New York Times, we have on the business section the entire middle page taken with "Win third place on the rich list just isn't enough. Casino multi-billionaire takes aim at Bill Gates and most of Las Vegas. Sheldon Adelson, the casino mogul, has seen his personal net worth plummet by more than $15 billion. He still is worth $28 billion, and he's just finished building the largest casino in the world. Now, here's two things that interest me. The Venetian Resort Hotel Casino in Las Vegas, which is opening, I guess, tomorrow, will have 7,200 rooms. Now, I refuse to lecture in Las Vegas just on ethical principles, because I consider it so utterly decadent morally and spiritually. I also find it has the worst taste in the world. And like, there's a volcano that's not a volcano. There's fountains which are not real fountains. Everything is just superficial. But they're talking as if this man needs to be the richest man in America. And I have to ask, why? What's he so insecure about now? And who's going to fill those 7,200 rooms at a time when people have more debt than ever before, when a lot of people who filled out applications for subprime mortgages, 85% gave wrong information. They frequently listed as their salary five times more than what they actually earned, putting himself into a position to actually be victimized. So now, are those the people? Who's going to go and fill up not only that hotel's rooms, but hundreds of thousands of other rooms to do what? Gamble, when everyone knows that the house wins? And for what? Is this just another form of superficial chance for euphoria, when in the process you're going to end up causing yourself even more pain? Because when you go home and then those bills come from the hotel and the money you lost and your stress levels, what are you going to look for next? So I think that at some point we have to shift our whole perspective of stop sublimating. I don't know about India, but I do know in America the number one addiction is comfort addiction. We're really crazy for security, and comfort equals security. So if it's the comfort of a cheesecake when we're already overweight and have diabetes, or whether it's the comfort of a hamburger when our heart is already rapidly beating and our arteries are clogged, or whether it's a dysfunctional relationship because we feel so empty that we need someone else in our life to so-called fill up the void in our life, then I'm concerned that we are not touching what is important and what is real. And it was the great writer Thomas Mann in this last century 1920s, who said a man lives not only his personal life as an individual, but also consciously and unconsciously the life of his epoch and his contemporaries. How then do we see when people are not willing to even dialogue on this? People are not willing to look out of their own comforts. If there's anything asked or required of them beyond their comfort, they would draw in and say, I don't like your conversation. It's not happy conversation. So then we live this kind of pseudo-blissful, the secret dialogue. Let's make, a crappy little book, a bestseller, promising people that, the secret to everything is just visualize it and put the energy out and it's going to come to you. That's not how life works. So my final comment on this is that we have also made the mistake of making science the final arbiter of everything that is supposed to be good. And yet, when we examine science today, we see so much of it is extremely subjective and has ignored completely the mind in general and the spiritual insights of the different world metaphysicians in particular. And would you give us your insight, please? Do you believe we're at the threshold of a major scientific revolution, a paradigm shift about how we understand consciousness? And would you identify the most vital core elements of spirituality and science? Is there a common ground so that we can go to that area where science no longer limits us, but actually expands our ability to understand consciousness?
It's a marvelous question. And are we on the verge of such a radical paradigm shift, a very, very deep revolution in the sciences? I think we certainly have that potential. Whether or not it will happen will depend on many, many factors. Nowadays, science is so radically different than science a century ago. Science is big business. Science is billions of dollars. Science is enormous power. Science is welded with business and is welded with government in ways that were not even remotely paralleled in the late 19th century. And so when you have such enormous power and wealth involved in the pursuit of understanding and knowledge, you can be sure that there are a lot that science is not even remotely value-free. Science is walking around with great big money bags strapped to its belt. And so the type of science that is pursued is the type of science that corporations, that government, that major institutions want to see happen. It's never been value-free, and now it is absolutely in bed with business and government. Nevertheless, it is a marvelous orientation towards the study of truth, of the natural world, and science, especially over the last century, has been fixated on the external world. So as you say, the mind tends to be overlooked. I wrote a book called The Taboo of Subjectivity, that the very notion of subjectivity is regarded by many scientists as being antithetical to science, but oddly enough, again, the very values that permeate science are thoroughly subjective. The minds that come up with science and come up with systems of measurement, hypotheses, and so forth, it's all the mind. And so I think we are facing a crisis here in so many ways. I mean, it's fairly obvious. But time of crisis, also a time of enormous potential. And I see it in two areas. One is very pragmatic. It's down to earth. It's something we can all relate to, and that is our human flourishing. I had an experience 37 years ago when I first went off to India. 1971 it was. And I moved into a Tibetan refugee community in the north of India, a place called Dharamsala, where the Dalai Lama had settled. And I'd come from a relatively affluent background. My parents live in Southern California. We traveled extensively, lived in Europe. I learned how to drive a car, a stick shift on my dad's Porsche. So we are not fabulously wealthy, but definitely well off. And now I was living for the first time in a refugee community. I lived there for 4 years, the most impoverished people I'd ever met. But not only impoverished, these people had gone through a genocide. This little town, this little village of McLeod Gunj up above Dharamsala, it was a few thousand people. They're all refugees. They'd all gone through tremendous trauma, misery, anguish. They'd lost loved ones. They'd lost all their property. They had been uprooted from their own country, fleeing, at the risk of their lives. These should have been the most miserable people that I'd ever met, given the adversity they'd experienced. And it astonished me. These were the happiest people I'd ever met. They're living in abject poverty. I was living with them. I was living with them for $10, $15 a month, because I also had very little money. But, of course, I could always fly back home. They had no home to fly back to. What's going on here? That people who had not only gone through such tremendous adversity, but right then experiencing really abject poverty, many of them, how could they be so happy? What were they tapping into? They were tapping into, this is a whole culture, not just a few monks or yogis here and there. What were they tapping into? They knew from their own culture, this Tibetan Buddhist culture, led with tremendous inspiration by the Dalai Lama. How can you tap into inner resources of well-being, of security? You spoke of comfort and security, not correlated with your bank account or how big your house is or how many flat-screen TVs you have, but a sense of security, a sense of well-being, because you've cultivated a realistic attitude towards life. And I think to a large extent they were rooted in that, and they gave them an enormous resilience, their psychological immune system preventing them, protecting them from falling into depression, misery, anguish, resentment, hatred, vengeance. So many things can come out of adversity. Why aren't all the Tibetans rallying around terrorists to try to, you know, blow up China, blow up their embassies and so forth? They're not doing that. Why are they following this theme of nonviolence? Because they have been led by their own leaders, people like the Dalai Lama, that this is not the way to deal with adversity. Let us deal with this realistically, and let's cultivate a sense of well-being from the inside out. So are we? So this is one pragmatic side, where science is not faced off against religion as who's going to win. Is it going to be the creationists? Is it going to be the intelligent design? Is it going to be the evangelicals and the fundamentalists, whether Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, Muslim, or what have you? Who's going to win, the scientists or the religious people? I think that's a terrible question. And a lot of people would love to have us believe that. It's a win-loss situation. Science stands for truth and justice. Religion stands for superstition and religious wars. Oh, no, wait a minute. Science is devoid of meaning. It's flat. It's secular. It's amoral. It's dehumanizing. And religion stands for the word of God, for ultimate truth. I despise the whole framing of that issue. It's destructive to all of us who love science and have a religious orientation or a spiritual orientation towards reality. The problems we're facing in today's world are so dire. They are so deep that this type of polarized thinking, you know, let's exterminate religion. No, I mean, let's exterminate secularism. Let's exterminate. These are just part of the problem. These polarizers, these people who are driven by their own hatred of people who have mindsets and belief systems different than their own, that I reject. I don't reject any particular religion. I certainly don't reject science. But this intolerant mindset, we have all the answers, we have all the only way, whether it's Buddhist, Christian, whether it's science or Islam, that is part of the problem. So to bring this together on this theme that I was just addressing with respect to this little village of McLeod Ganj up in the Himalayas, what was it? This is a scientific question. How could these people who have gone through such inconceivable adversity, genocide, poverty, ill health, living in an alien country with alien language and climate and food and everything, how could they flourish just 12 years after they came into exile, which is when I joined them in 1971? How could they? This is a scientific question. What gave rise to their sense of well-being? And we can see this replicated in many other traditional cultures as well. Tibet is simply a paradigm of this. The scientific question of raising the issue of genuine happiness, or this Greek notion eudaimonia, which is profoundly a spiritual issue, make it equally a scientific issue. Let us explore this. What is it that enables people to flourish? What are they cultivating in terms of their ethical way of life, avoiding injury to themselves and others, bringing a sense of conscientious caring to themselves and others, recognizing that their very existence as individuals, as well as societies, as nations, is profoundly, inextricably interdependent with all those around us. The notion that we can be patriotic in the sense that, yay, America, and screw everybody else, it may as well be put in a mental asylum. It is completely nuts. The environment knows no boundaries. A boundary between Mexico and the United States? What is air or water? You know, where's the boundary? Environmentalists know there are no boundaries on planet Earth.
Isn't this a part of what you consider the theory of ontological relativity, drawing from both Buddhist meditation theory and the laws of relativity, which suggest that mental phenomena are conditioned by the brain but do not emerge from it? Instead, the entire natural world of mind and matter, subjects and objects, arises from a unitary dimension of reality that is more fundamental than the dualities which arise from this dimension?
Indeed so. And this we find in Buddhism, we find it in the writings of Carl Jung, but it's not only kind of esoteric or metaphysical psychology or spirituality. We find it in the writings of Roger Penrose, a brilliant mathematical physicist, Oxford University, Wolfgang Pauli, a Nobel laureate writing back in the 1950s in correspondence with Carl Jung. This is absolutely cutting-edge physics, but it's bringing consciousness into the realm of the physical world and saying, hey, this is not an epiphenomenon, a little emergent property somehow mysteriously rising out of the brain like some invisible vapor. Consciousness, in fact, has a central role in the very nature of reality itself, and we are experiencing the human configuration of consciousness by way of the human psyche. But this theme of profound, essential interdependence is indeed what I'm getting at in this book, Hidden Dimensions, of ontological relativity. So there's one element of this, the pragmatic element of this, is that you're flourishing in mind, and my friends in India and in China and Tibet and South America, that our well-being, our flourishing is profoundly interdependent among these various human societies, profoundly interdependent with our environment. And to think that we can turn our backs on the rest of the world with an us-them mentality, and an us-them mentality with regards to the natural environment, how can we conquer nature? One of the most absurd phrases ever formulated by humanity. This is nuts. This whole notion of interdependence, mutual interdependence, I think is simply real, and the pragmatic manifestation of that in our lives is ethics. And so what I'd love to see here on this pragmatic side is that this become part of our modern education. It's not just reading, writing, and arithmetic, get a job and become a productive member of society. But as children are learning what they do indeed need to learn in terms of the basic curriculum that's already there, why aren't we all also teaching them from kindergarten on, how can you flourish as a human being, whether you're rich, whether you're middle class, or even you fall into poverty? How can you flourish as a human being? What can you do to empower yourself? When you raise this issue of the man who's only the third wealthiest man in the United States, as we would all think, boo-hoo, but why is even thinking about becoming number two and then eventually number one? What's wrong with him? Well, what's wrong with him is what's wrong with most of us, and that is we are identifying our very sense of self-worth with something that is not us. Identifying how good a person am I, what is my worth, how good am I?
The provings.
The proving, and then finding a quantitative criterion to evaluate that. Oh, I'm only number three in the United States. You know, I just heard recently, number one in the world, the richest man in the world, now surpassing Bill Gates, I've heard, I have not corroborated this, is actually somebody down in Mexico.
Yeah, it is.
Where poverty is 60%. 60% of the whole population is living beneath the poverty threshold, and this man now can get on top of the dung heap and go cockle-doodle-doo, I'm the richest man in the world.
Yeah, man,
what a travesty.
Pittance.
How shameless.
It is, but when the whole belief system stresses winning at all costs, then American Idol or Dancing with the Stars or reality television or gladiator shows or boxing or football, we don't want to be associated with anyone who's not winning, so we associate irrespective of the destructive emotions that arise and block our positive emotions, such as compassion and love. And I believe it's inherent to the human being, not simply learned behavior, though learned behavior is layered on top of that. Let me give you one final example. I had a little tiny capuchin monkey. Now, at 3 months of age, they weigh about 5 ounces and could sit right in the palm of your hand. And I had her there all day long. And I put her in a little pocket that I had sewn onto my shirt. So every time she opened her little eyes, I'd give her her bottle, and I'd change her diaper, and I'd give her a little massage and give her hugs and kisses. And then I was asked, would I take in an abandoned couple of similar animals? I said, fine. And the two enclosures were close together. Well, in the wild, one of the natural predators are cats, any kind of cat. And yet I watched. The moment a cat came down, we have a cat named Sally, the moment Sally came down the road, the two would go way up into the top of their enclosure. But I'm watching one day, and I see little Precious taking grapes and throwing them out of the cage. And the cat comes over and didn't like them. So then she runs up and she gets carrots. And then she gets all, finally she got a little capuchin bar, and she brought it down. It's a little grain and pressed grain. She threw it out, and the cat liked it. Well, the cat got close enough to her, And then each day the cat would come closer until one day she got the cat close enough she could reach her arm out and pet the cat's head. Well, 3 weeks later, the cat's coming over every day, laying beside her enclosure so she can pet the cat's belly, play with its ears, groom it. Now, then a dog comes, and a dog is a predator. And yet the dog comes over, and she sticks her head right up there and gives a dog a kiss. Now, every day the dog pulls over there, wants to go over there and gets another kiss. And she made every predator into a friend. And I was interested in watching what will happen to the other creatures watching this. And sure enough, in time, the other creatures started to pet the cat. And now, every day, you'll see the cat going from enclosure to enclosure, laying outside. And she's a big cat, bigger than these, and getting groomed. And then giving little licks to the animals. So when I've seen this behavior, it tells me something more profound than any study. And that is, we all are born with the capacity to unite. I believe we are united until we start finding rationale to disconnect from one another through the destructive emotions of anger, pain, resentment, envy, jealousy, and the sense that somehow we should be the dominant ideology. And I just think it's unfortunate.
It certainly is. It's a beautiful story, and so suggestive of ways that we might apply our own imaginations to people we regard as our enemies, we regard as predators who imperil our security. And of course, the whole issue of terrorism, war on terrorism, rather than speaking with them. And so this does relate to this issue of the interface between science and spirituality. As you were speaking, I recalled, are you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, I was just hearing some background noise. There was a comment made by several years ago by the Dalai Lama in one of our Mind and Life meetings. This is meetings with the Dalai Lama and various scientists, for which I've had the privilege to be a co-interpreter and often a participant in these meetings. And it was a meeting, I think, that Dan Goleman wrote up as a book called Destructive Emotions, and the Dalai Lama commented that he felt the deepest impulse in the human mind, the human spirit, is the impulse of caring. The impulse of caring. It's something we don't need to learn. And that is, I care about my health, I care about my happiness, I care about not being harmed, and I don't need to work at it. It's deeply ingrained in my very being as anything else. But there is the principle or the impulse of caring. And then, as you just said, here it is absolutely part of human nature, caring. But it's caring that by its nature is not confined to me. And we're finding this in the story that you just told, we're finding it of species, across species, dolphins, porpoises, and so forth, who help across species. We're finding in human communities, the issue is, here is a natural impulse, a profound impulse. From a religious perspective, we might even say its source is divine, as in love, as in compassion, most fundamental, the principle of caring. What can we do, again, in the education system to help educate children on how they can cultivate their inner sources of well-being, religious or non-religious? That's their choice, the choice of their families. We're not trying to indoctrinate them into any ideology, but give them tools, skills, so that when they are pursuing happiness, and we all want greater happiness, we want greater fulfillment, and so many of us are fixated on the notion that I can only get it if I get more stuff. But with 6 billion people on this finite planet, there just isn't enough, and we're using up non-replenishable resources. But the resources of the human spirit are replenishable. We can tap into them deeply. Bring this into the environment. Let it be a scientific question. Let it be a spiritual question. The very nature of consciousness. Let it be spiritual. Let it be scientific. And you know, I just received an email a couple of days ago from someone at UCLA that's telling me they're starting an endowed chair in consciousness studies led by a world-class neuroscientist. But the whole design of this endowed chair is to bring in spirituality, bring in mysticism, we can use the M word, contemplative practice, together with psychology and the state-of-the-art brain scans, the EEG, and all of this, so that we can come in and develop a multifaceted, multidimensional understanding of consciousness, drawing from the best of the great contemplative traditions of the world, from modern science, and in this way enrich our very understanding of what it means to be human, what the very nature of the mind is, and possibly get out of the rut of thinking there's only one possible answer, and the mind is just an epiphenomenon of the brain, and after all, we are just biological robots functioning according to the inexorable, mindless laws of physics and biology. That may be true. It's never been demonstrated. But when we bring in methodologies, modes of inquiry, drawn from the great spiritual traditions of the world, we open up science. We broaden its horizons, that it may take on a dimension that has never had before, where, in fact, ethics is integral to science rather than being a slap-on that is legislated by some kind of a Congress or that is convened by scientific organizations of things they should and should not do, as in how they can treat subjects in, you know, scientific research, that ethics actually comes out of our scientific understanding of human flourishing and how we can flourish amongst ourselves as human beings in human communities, how we can flourish in relationship to our natural environment.
Alan, we're out of time. Mm-hmm. I want to thank you very much for being with us today, and I look forward to us having another conversation.
That would be a pleasure, Gary. You've raised enormously important issues.
Thank you. My guest, Dr. Alan Wallace. He is the author of Embracing Mind, The Common Ground of Science and Spirituality, as well as Hidden Dimensions, The Unification of Physics and Consciousness.